Does Seattle have the soul of a longshoreman, the soul of a Hoops fan? Can we have both at the same time? This is KUOW's Week in Review. Happy Friday. I'm Bill Radke. Our first question this hour, should the city of Seattle give two blocks of a street in SoTo to a developer to build a new basketball and hockey stadium? The city is debating that right now. You can tell your council members what you want, so let's figure this out. Opposing the arena is Seattle land use attorney Cleveland Stockmeyer, who says a new arena in SoTo is an attack on this city's industrial character.
The city cannot be turned over, not all of it, to high-tech jobs and high-priced condos. If you do not preserve light industrial, if you do not preserve the infrastructure we have, this freight rail, marine rail nexus, it will be gone. It's really all about, you know, can high-tech and the gentrification have all of Seattle or not? Will we keep our soul or not, our diversity?
Is this arena debate about Seattle's soul? We asked stadium supporter Brian Robinson with the blog SonicsRising.com.
I say the soul of a community is constantly evolving, and anyone who says that they understand and define it and own it really is a NIMBY at heart. My family was raised in Industrial Ballard. My father was the president of the North Seattle Industrial Association. I've watched everything happen there. Thousands and thousands of people have talked about having a first-class venue for music, for sports. It brings a community together in a way that's just indefinable. So I'm proud of my soul, too.
Where is our soul? Sydney Brownstone, reporter for The Stranger, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
You've searched your soul, and you say, no way should we give Occidental Avenue to this developer, Chris Hansen. Why?
Well, first, let's be really clear about who Chris Hansen is. He's a billionaire. He's not just your average Hoops fan. He's a hedge fund manager. And I think both sides are wrong. I think this is a clash of two very powerful interests. We have the maritime industry on the one hand, who kind of opposes anyone infringing on their turf. And then you have Chris Hansen. And recently, the city council voted to hand over an alleyway to Amazon. I think when Seattleites are feeling the crunch of development, I think it's more important than ever to preserve public space, space that is truly public and not just give it away.
Public meaning, in this case, Occidental Avenue?
Yeah, or spaces for the public good. If we give Chris Hansen that space, what's it going to be used for? You know, those games, it's only going to make money when there are games. And I think that you can also upzone industrial areas and have it be mixed use. I want to live in a city that's dense, that's mixed use, that preserves our working waterfront, but also has space for residential and affordable housing.
Paul Guppy, Vice President for Research at the Washington Policy Center. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You're kind of a free market guy. You're okay with giving Chris Hansen the street he needs in SoTo, though? Why is that?
Well, giving someone a public street is not free market,
right?
Number one. I could see being in favor of this idea with many cautions and conditions. The main one being is that, just as was said, is that you don't turn public spaces over to private interests without doing it very, very carefully. I mentioned to the producer before that in Oklahoma City, when they rebuilt the federal complex after the bombing there, they closed three public streets in order to make this larger area. And so that works for planning. That's a case of where it's the federal government. And by the way, those spaces are open to the public anyway, even though the streets are closed. So it can be done in a planned way. But I agree with the comment earlier that says we need to preserve the character of the city and the diversity of our economy that keeps a good blue-collar union family wage jobs here, but also the variety of job opportunities there are. So we're just not entirely high-tech development, upscale. I think it would be a mistake to move in that direction.
So the city is deciding whether to, and there's going to be a lot more to come. This is just a little piece of it, this decision on Occidental Avenue. But I want to know, where do you come down? What should the city council do?
I think they're okay for approving it with the caveat that it has to serve the general public interest, number one. Number two, I would say, what's the fallback? If this plan doesn't work, which often happens, the financing falls through, then the public should get the street back. It shouldn't just turn into private property entirely. And then the last point I would make very firmly is no subsidies, no tax or public support for this private venture. If they can make it fly and it serves the purpose of the city, okay. But I don't think that there should be that taxpayers and the public should be expected to guarantee a profit for this project. They need to make it on their own if they're going to try it at all.
Also with us on the Weekend Review, Maude Dodome, President, CEO of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. You represent the business community. Is giving away this street to build an arena good for Seattle business?
I think the first question I'd ask if I was sitting on the city council is, okay, so where's the team? I mean, this has been a big question for quite some time.
For those who don't know, the NBA is not adding teams anytime soon. They've said so.
So, I mean, I appreciate that we have Sonics fans that miss the Sonics, and I think, you know, all of us love sporting events in one way, shape, or form. But I think the burden of proof lies on the developer to say, actually, we have a real project here, and I think that's still a big question mark. As to the soul of the city question, I think we are in a period of dramatic change in our city. There's no question about it. And I am very interested in seeing how this debate plays out on this question, because I think that part of our city has really got to struggle through some questions about its vision for itself.
What part of the city?
The Soto, Pioneer Square. I mean, let's face it, it's a lot of the city, but that neighborhood is in the process of transformational change. And as others have said, I do think we want to be a city that allows a wide range of people to live here, work here, and afford to be here. And so some of the recent policy decisions, I think, that have been good ones to help us with that, the housing affordability plan, more transit investment, these things will help us dramatically. But we need to focus, too, on keeping our middle-wage, middle-income pathway jobs here in the city and not lose them, as so many other cities have, most notably San Francisco.
So that's an argument for economic diversity, business diversity, affordability diversity. Do any of you buy that this is also a conversation about a working waterfront, a maritime history and fabric that is part of our quote-unquote soul?
I do. I buy that. I mean, just to jump right back on that,
sure.
Because I feel like those jobs, those middle income jobs that are actually fantastic pathway jobs. I mean, you talk to some of those employers and a lot of those folks come through, you know, some training into a job where they can have a living wage position for their lifetime. And you go and talk to the workers there and they're like, this is the best thing I could possibly do for myself and my family. I love working in this environment. It's not for everybody, but for a chunk of our community, it's a really great pathway. So,
So I think the sole argument is beyond the economic diversity, et cetera, argument has to do with working with your hands. It has to do with history. It has to do with sparkling blue water. It has, you know. So I'm just I ask because the hard part about soul arguments for me is that on the one hand, well, that's what life's about. I mean, it's not about money and possessions. It's about soul. On the other hand, if we don't know what we mean by soul, then what's the argument? We used to have a lot of things here. We had loggers and brothels and fur trappers. And before the port, native people could fish in the Duwamish. I mean, did the port make life more soulful? It just seems very slippery to me. But I want to know did you have a handle on the soul argument?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to say the port actually played a large role in taking land away from the Duwamish people. So I don't think we should sentimentalize the glory days. And personally, as a woman, I think it's good to be living in the year 2016 than it has ever been. The other thing about sparkling blue waters, too, is that the waterfront's going to change dramatically no matter what over the next century because of climate change. So we're going to have to change what's there. It's a set of choices that we're forced to have, you know. It's going to have to change no matter what. So the decision is, what do we change it into? And so I think that the maritime industry is going to have to adapt, and it's going to not necessarily struggle with its soul, but struggle with becoming more efficient and more modern.
Paul, where's our soul? Where's your soul?
Well, what I think of is that we have to be careful, I guess, about over-planning or maybe over-envisioning, because to me the danger is that the waterfront and the industrial area in South Seattle, it's not a museum. It's not a cultural artifact that we're trying to preserve. I think what we should recognize is that it's a vibrant area with a lot of business and manufacturing. One thing I think of is that, you know, when elephants struggle, ants get trampled. So here's a great big development interest in the port and these big government agencies. But underneath that is a really vibrant and dynamic, entrepreneurial, competitive businesses of light manufacturing, transportation, lots of craft jobs. And it's that kind of diversity and ferment that we should try to preserve. We're building on an investment and history that's been there for a long time. And I think what we have to be careful of is not to lose that. So hang on to what we have as we add and build more. And then the question about soul and culture and the identity of the city kind of takes care of itself. That's how you identify what kind of place Seattle is that it has this constant openings, not just in high tech, but if you want to open your little distribution center in South Seattle near the port, you should still be able to do that.
I hear a unanimous argument for not having an economic monoculture.
Exactly.
No matter where you're coming
Which
from.
Which would be boring and probably bad policy, because whatever that mono business is will run into a slump in the future, and then we're all in trouble.
The City Council of Seattle is going to hold the last of three public hearings on this very question, whether or not to give, in this most near-term case, whether or not to give two blocks of Occidental Avenue to sports developer Chris Hansen. And then there are a whole lot of other hurdles and decisions that would come after that before we would see a stadium here. But this final public hearing, if you're interested, it's a week from Tuesday, so April 18th, 9:30 in the morning at City Hall. The jungle is a problem. Is a fence the answer? This is KUOW's Week in Review. The state has approved $1 million to spend on the unauthorized homeless encampment under I-5 and I-90 near Beacon Hill. And one option is a fence around the jungle topped with razor wire. One city council member called fencing the jungle absolutely insane. Another called it a complete waste of money. A third said we shouldn't be building a fence on the southern border, meaning Mexico, and we shouldn't be building a fence on the I-5 corridor. Paul Guppy, why do you think fencing off the jungle could be a good idea?
Because a fence is a tool for control. This is public land, and if public agencies see that there's a problem or a danger or a nuisance, then building a fence is one way to get control of that area, just physically, for public safety. That, of course, doesn't get at in any way the underlying problem of homelessness, how to get people into treatment and how to help them. So it's a very limited tool, as I say, and I guess it's $1 million seems like a lot, but if that's what it takes.
Well, it's not $1 million for a fence, but there would be, it will cost money to clean up the jungle.
Yeah,
roads that go through right. there sort of inadequately to service to get in there. And so there's things to spend money on.
So it's just the government, you know, establishing order in an area where right now there's chaos and disorder and it's dangerous. And by the way, if there were a private property that was a public nuisance or dangerous in some way that kids were getting in and getting injured, then we would demand that the private property owner control the area and put up a fence. And so, it's good as far as it goes, but it does not begin to get at the deeper social problem of helping the homeless and what to do about that.
Sydney, the Seattle Times reports that in the last 5 years, the jungle's been the source of 750 emergency calls, 250 including fires. There are assaults, overdoses, rapes, two people shot to death and three wounded in January. Human waste flows from open latrines. Why should we not spend this money to fence off the jungle?
Yeah, I mean, I think building a fence around the jungle is the dumbest and most dehumanizing idea I've ever heard. But I actually, as opposed to Paul, I think that the jungle is a symptom of the order that we already have. This is just excess from the system of the war on drugs. There's a reason why people go to the jungle. Why do they go? Because they've been policed out of other areas like downtown and Capitol Hill. And we treat them like they're moral failures of our society and we don't give them access to treatment. So I think the jungle is a symptom of a larger problem that is our own making, and putting a fence around it won't do anything. I'm strongly supportive of supervised consumption sites, and I think we should take that $1 million and put it more towards addiction treatment.
In fact, we're going to talk about a so-called safe use site in a few minutes here on the Week in Review, and we're going to get at this question of whether we have told drug users that they're moral failures. So more to come on that. You mentioned, Sydney, that people have been policed out of other areas, which makes me think of business districts that don't want homeless people there, which brings me to Ma Dodon. You say you work with the businesses, with the Chamber of Commerce. So how do you feel about ultimately the decision to fence off the jungle?
Well, I think we have a tremendous homelessness problem. It's a crisis, really, and it's not limited to any one place in our city. It's actually a regional crisis. And I think the numbers just were that it's up 20% from even the year before, which was up about 15% from the year before. This is an incredible surge of people not having a place to call home. So, you know, it's hard to say that living underneath a highway, which is where the jungle is a very safe, good place to live. And I think the key to this is actually to find alternatives for people, safe places that are not experiencing the statistics you just gave us, Bill. I mean, you know, who would want to live in that kind of environment if they had other decent choices? So we've seen in this state, you know, with the decline of mental health funding, which is just recently been restored to some degree, with the decline of some treatment options, we've seen a huge challenge here. And I do think you've seen our county executive and our mayor both declare this a state of emergency. I think it is an emergency. And I think, you know, that's the issue. That is the challenge. The fence or no fence is just a symptomatic. It's not the critical issue. The critical issue is what are we doing to safely take care of these folks?
Agreed. We've talked about addiction treatment, mental health services, alternative housing, assistance to families with children, safe injection sites. So there's a lot to talk about there. I want to focus in on what some of the city council members talked about, an insanity of doing this. And Sydney, you use the term dehumanizing. Why is it dehumanizing to try to keep people out of such a dangerous, miserable place?
Bill, what do you think is their alternative?
Well, that's a whole bunch of individual stories.
Right. But since when has putting a fence to keep people out of somewhere been a humanizing choice? I mean, I think we can all look back on history and say that hasn't helped anyone. I mean, just look at what's going on in another jungle in Calais, where refugees escaping turmoil in Syria are. You know, there are residents who want to put a fence around them, but that has more to do with fear than actual empathy for their situations.
Would a fence be okay if it came along with all the services that I just listed? Is a fence itself the issue?
I think one of the biggest issues that the fence represents is stigma. We have stigmatized drug users in our society to the extent that no one wants to help them. They want, you know, businesses want them to be swept under the rug, out of sight, out of mind. And that actually ignores the issues at hand. And, you know, when someone is addicted to drugs, their brain chemistry changes. It doesn't make them a bad person. And we've chosen to make certain drugs illegal. Heroin is illegal, although chemically, the chemistry is very similar to opiates that are on the market. It's the same difference between cocaine and crack. We've chosen to give harsher mandatory minimums for one over the other. And I just think that a fence will worsen the stigma against drug users, and that's something we really need to actively undo.
You don't want people to be out of sight and out of mind, but isn't that just what that area under the freeway is out of sight and out of mind? Maybe it would be better to have people go and, as you say, you know, be policed out of other places. So now we're having that debate in a very visible way instead of people being invisible and in trouble.
I think we've been playing this cat and mouse game ever since the invention of the war on drugs. You squeeze drug users out of one area, you continue to criminalize poverty, and they just go somewhere else. I don't think forcing them out of the jungle is going to put them in a better situation.
Paul?
So what's the question?
We've raised a whole bunch in there.
Exactly.
What got to you?
About what to do regarding homelessness? I'll address the question about the fence, since that's the main topic, is that we just have to recognize how limited that is. So if the authorities, the government, in this case the mayor or the state, This is a public space, and it's a matter of establishing control over a public space where there's a lot of crime and lawbreaking going on. But that's very limited, and I think maybe we agree on that, because it doesn't solve the underlying problem of how to provide services and help people with their addiction, provide funding, shelter and housing and beds where people can go and not live in what is kind of the wild, wild west. I mean, it's a lawless area based on the statistics that you're pointing out, and that's the main thing that a community has to be concerned about. Is do we have reasonable control over the public spaces where there's safety and people don't get hurt? And what has to go along with that is social programs and support to help people deal with their underlying problem, which is the cause of why they're shooting up under the freeway to begin with.
Maude, we have a transit levy and a parks levy and a lot of other things. We have the housing levy coming up. What are the odds that the business community, and you're with the chamber, how is the business community behind all the things I mentioned, the alternatives that you mentioned, the addiction services, all of it?
We have actually, we just did a tally of this because of a different question that was asked. And it's in the last 2 years, the chamber itself has supported over $4 billion of new initiatives to really double down our investment in this community right now as we are experiencing this radical change and trying to get ahead. We are, I think, woefully behind addressing some of our critical issues in transit, housing affordability, et cetera. So those range from, you know, everything from the kindergarten program that we now have, the pre-kindergarten program, to Best Starts for Kids, to investment in our public schools, to housing, to transit, Move Seattle. We are taking a hard look now at the Sound Transit proposal, which we're very interested in and I think largely very supportive of. We have to look at all the details still to get to an affirmative. But we were very instrumental in helping to pass the state transportation package, which when you add it all together comes to like $35 billion. Of willingness on the part of the business community to stand behind and say, yes, this is the time to make these critical investments. We need to invest in Washington State, in the Seattle region, to take care of these issues. So I think we are, you know, we're becoming a much more urban center. And I think, you know, to really accommodate that takes investment, and the business community is stepping up.
The state legislature, again, has approved $1 million to spend on the jungle. One option includes a fence around that jungle topped with razor wire, and then the rest of the money would go to cleaning out the camps, improving the access roads there. And we are going to talk about whether Seattle ought to become the first American city to have a public place where drug users can inject and smoke under medical supervision. That's coming up in about 10 minutes on KUOW. KUOW's Week in Review. By the way, baseball season starts tonight.
Tonight.
At Safeco Field.
Yay.
Mariners home
play
opener.
Ball.
Play ball. They played ball for three games on the road, so this is just the home opener. They won two out of three of those, with the only loss coming with pitcher Felix Hernandez on the mound. So if we can just work around that guy, the weak spot in the lineup,
exactly,
we'll make the playoffs. Or maybe the Mariners will begin to slowly bore a tunnel underneath the waterfront and travel 1,000 feet and hit a buried pipe and stall in the mud under a sinkhole. We don't know yet, but hope springs eternal. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. So we've been raising the minimum wage for a year now. How's that working out? 1 year ago, Seattle started raising its minimum wage gradually toward $15 an hour. Critics predicted jobs would go away because economics 101. When it's more expensive to employ people, fewer people get employed. Fans of the higher minimum said that would not happen, and it's about time people on the bottom rung can afford a decent life. Maude, you work directly with businesses at the Chamber of Commerce. What are they telling you about the effect of Seattle's rising minimum wage?
Well, I think you hear anecdotal evidence of various things. I don't think it's way too early to really know what the impact is going to be over time. Obviously, the increment.
It's not even at 15 yet. It's at 13.
It's
right? Depending
well
on
below
the business.
That. Depending, right? Exactly. And so the anecdotal stuff we hear obviously is not news to people. We've seen a change in the model a little bit at some restaurants to go to a service charge. So far, you know, for some of those restaurants, it appears to be working just fine. Others have said, no, we're going back to a tipping system. I've heard from some, you know, folks that have light industrial manufacturing type facilities in our city that they're considering other locations. Some have made a decision to leave, but I also hear it's a multitude of things. Again, going back to our previous conversation, you know, rising land cost and rent, proximity of employees to a facility, and then, of course, you know, the question about rising wages as well. So I think it's too early to know. I do think we are at the sort of at the tip of an experiment, and I think it's incumbent on us to actually do a very good job of analyzing this over time. But I'm not sure we're far enough into it to really assess yet what it means.
Sydney, what effect are you seeing? Is it backing up what you already thought, or do you also think it's too early to tell?
Yeah, I mean, when low-wage workers were fighting for $15 an hour, we had big businesses, the Washington Restaurant Association, saying the equivalent of the sky is going to fall. And there's a University of Washington researcher who's actually looking at empirical evidence on this, and he was quoted in the Seattle Times saying the sky hasn't fallen. So, we have the beginnings of empirical evidence beginning to show us that we had no reason to trust the people with deep pockets who weren't willing to pay their workers a living wage.
Paul, is that fair? The sky's still there.
Sure, the sky's still there. And
15 now, they were right.
Well, no, they were wrong because their name is 15 now, but they are stretching it out over 7 years, which I think is a concession on their part of the shock that jumping up this price control, this mandatory law, has to the labor market and the impact that it has on workers and businesses, particularly small businesses. So I think, first of all, they're admitting that going to 15 now, as it's called, is impossible, and therefore they're going to do it over 7 years. California is also doing it until 2022.
But so far, so good?
Well, sure. And that's my second point, is that I think the evidence is always going to be anecdotal because there's no the people who are impacted are invisible. So there's a wage that's lower than the minimum wage, and that's zero. When people can't find work at all, it's one thing to say, you know, when working people get a raise, that's great. If you have a job, if you don't have a job or can't find one, and we have a family friend who worked at the airport, he was a baggage handler and he got laid off. Now, the company that hired him didn't say, we're laying you off because of the minimum wage. They presented all kinds of different reasons. So we're always going to be in that situation where you have to make a judgment about what is the impact on this. I do think we're moving to a regional economy, if we keep going in this direction, where chronic high youth unemployment is going to be a permanent feature of our area, that young people will just have a very hard time finding jobs, that there will be less opportunity. And we were talking earlier about blue-collar jobs and that kind of, you know, creativity and ferment that you want kind of at the lower end. And what the high minimum wage does is cut that off. Someone who voluntarily wants to work for 14 legally can't. They can go into the underground economy where they're more likely to be victimized, or they can have no job at all. And that's the situation they're put in.
Sydney, will you acknowledge that that is economics 101? There'll be fewer jobs to have?
I think it's an economic fallacy that that University of Washington researcher I was talking about said that there's no evidence whatsoever that minimum wage has led to less employment. It doesn't exist. So I'm not sure where...
I think he'll never find a measurement of that because he's measuring a negative. He's measuring something that's not happening.
But when you also talk about the underground economy, I've interviewed a number of sex workers, for example, who are now able to work for $15 an hour. You know, that's a good thing. Now they don't have to sell their bodies if they were in a place where they were doing that for survival's sake anyway. So I'm not sure I'm following you.
You want to let her follow you before I move on to Maude?
You want me to comment on the sex economy? I'm not sure if there's any amount of money at which people should be doing that. I think it exploits people. But regarding the mainstream legal economy that's above board, it's pretty simple mechanism, which is a minimum wage is a price control, and it's a fiat, you know, a rule that's imposed from the outside that tells willing workers and willing employers that they cannot make a voluntary arrangement at some dollar level, $14.50 an hour, let's say. And even when a person wants to work, they're not allowed to. And I think that's the major effect that it's having.
Maude, the Seattle Times quoted this coffee shop owner as saying, the minimum wage increase has had a huge impact on my small business, but that's not the point. It's good for the community and will ideally lay the foundation for national policy. A living wage is essential, and if it means the end of my business, so be it. Is that an endorsement?
I don't know. That's a good question.
He's volunteering for that position. And people who work for him who would like to continue working might have a different attitude about it. The other thing that happens is that you're going to see a lot more automation. So particularly in the restaurant world. So rather than having a server come to you or a host or waiters, the customers are going to be asked to do that work on a touchscreen. And I think that's the direction we're going.
I do think there's more automation coming. I agree with that point. I also think the point about summer youth and youth in general is a very critical one. And I do think during the time when this minimum wage is being negotiated, which the chamber played a role in, that issue came up. And I do think it's an unresolved one in our community. We need to find pathways for people to get into the workforce. And I do worry, too, that we can't stop at thinking $15 an hour is actually going to be enough to have a living wage job. It really isn't in our city right now, which is why all the other things, the housing affordability, the investment in good training and education, and retaining these pathway jobs is so critical. And nothing, I think we're losing 20% of our kids are not even graduating from high school right now because they don't have, I guess, hope that there will be a living wage job for them. I think we really need to do a better job of connecting, and there's some initiatives underway that the chamber's engaged in to do that. I think that's where we need to go. I think it's about education and people having the opportunity as much as any wage level or any set of benefits. It's really about giving people skills.
Of course, it's not raising everyone's wages, just the lowest paid people, which is annoying some workers who used to feel good about having achieved something, getting paid more for the work they've done or the time they put in.
It's true.
What do you tell somebody who's irritated that now I'm on the bottom?
So
employers will tell you that there's been a bow wave impact of that, which means that those people who are annoyed are actually having to get bumped up as well. And so that's what we need to measure, really, is the cost of doing business in the city as a whole. We are fortunately in a really prosperous time. And so I think businesses are doing their best to kind of just adjust to this, and they've got enough business going on. But if we get into a recessionary period, it'll be interesting to see the impact of the accumulation of this.
Speaking of affordability, did anybody see Tim Egan's column in the New York Times? Headline, Dude, Where's My City? It's about how you can no longer afford to live in Seattle if you're a certain fictional character. He says that Kramer, the Seinfeld character who never held a real job, could not live in Seattle without a trust fund. Persuasive?
I fear we're going that direction without intervention. I think all the things we've talked about, the housing affordability measures, the transit measures, the need to focus on keeping our middle-income jobs, the education training initiatives. These are things that we now, in the next couple of years, have an opportunity to get ahead of and not become, and I've used this before, San Francisco. I think that's the model of where, we've got huge wage disparity. We've got people truly being left behind now, the economy. And I think Seattle, with its set of values and its ability to still get its arms around some of these things, has an opportunity to get ahead of it.
Of course, Kramer could afford to live in Manhattan.
Yeah, I mean, I think Timothy Egan made a good point. But the other thing to recognize here is that the person typically getting left behind is not someone who looks like Kramer. Mm. So I think the nature of cities has changed, right? I think you can't be a NIMBY stick in the mud. But at the same time, we need to look at gentrification and displacement and racial disparities and take those very seriously, because it I don't think anyone wants to live in a city that's segregated by race and income, and poorer people are forced to move to the outskirts.
You're listening to KOW's Week in Review. And again, a year ago, the city of Seattle started gradually raising its minimum wage. And by 2021, the minimum for all types of employers is scheduled to hit $15 per hour, $15 an hour. By the way, an idea that's taken hold in New York and California, and we'll all be waiting to see how it works out. Coming up, yep. Limited commercial advertising coming to your state parks. That's in about 10 minutes. You're learning about the week's news with Paul Guppy, Vice President for Research, Washington Policy Center, Maude Dodon, President, CEO of Seattle Chamber of Commerce, and Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Seattle could become the first American city to have a public place where drug users can inject and smoke under medical supervision. And Sydney, you talked about this earlier. You've written about this at The Stranger. Why should we approach drug use in this way we never have before?
Well, drug addiction, as differentiated from drug use, is a medical problem. It's a condition, and it should be treated as such. We've seen great successes with a supervised injection site in Vancouver called Insight. And The Lancet, actually, this esteemed medical journal, recently published a report from 22 international experts advocating decriminalization of all drugs and endorsing the idea of safe consumption sites. A meta-analysis showed that safe consumption sites decreased the transmission of HIV and hepatitis C by 69%. That's huge.
Before we get to decriminalization, and we might, Paul Guppy, you do not think that safe injection sites are the right answer for Seattle. Why is that?
Well, first of all, the phrase itself seems like an oxymoron. Is that how do you provide a safe place for people to do something that's inherently dangerous? And so what the authorities end up doing is sending a signal that they're tacitly approving or enabling a behavior which by its definition is self-destructive. So, you know, now the community is participating in helping people engage in behavior that hurts them and to put poisons into their body. So providing treatment on the road to recovery under the supervision of a doctor makes perfect sense. And if, you know, certain medications are needed for that, for a person to overcome their addiction and regain their health, that's a good idea. To provide, you know, an official government site that's community supported sends a signal that we're going to help you destroy yourself. And I think that's the wrong message to take.
We talked on KUOW with the head of a group called the People's Harm Reduction Alliance. And Shiloh Murphy told us that safe injection sites are not just about a place to use drugs. This is a place to make human beings feel valued.
I cannot tell you when people come to our syringe exchange, when we tell them we love you just the way you are, how many people burst into tears because that's the first person who's ever told them they're loved in years. And imagine if you went through life and you were not told you were loved. In fact, you were told you were worthless every day. You would make bad choices because you wouldn't believe you'd be there tomorrow and you wouldn't believe you deserved, you know, being disease free. And so our goal and our mission is really to combat the trillions of dollars to convince drug users that they're bad people.
Paul, this is the argument that our system of drug laws has left people feeling shamed and shunned and done more harm than good in many other ways, too.
Sure. So, again, that comment seems kind of confusing because how can you say to someone, I love you and care about you, and here's a needle so you can hurt yourself and put poisons inside your body? Organizations like St. Vincent de Paul, Goodwill, Salvation Army, and virtually any church mission or you know, homeless shelter that you can name has exactly that message of love and caring and respect and dignity for the human person, but not tolerating things that that person does in order to hurt themselves and destroy their health. So if you care about someone, the first thing you do is you say, I'm not going to participate in you harming yourself. We'll provide you with a way out, with support, with care and love and kindness, which is absolutely what's needed. But I think it sends a contradictory message if, on the other hand, you're saying, well, and this step over here and you can continue to, destroy your health, which is what these drugs do.
Sydney, why help people hurt themselves?
Well, first of all, I disagree with the notion that all drug use is inherently destructive. I think that's a lie that's been perpetrated by the U.S. government in funding certain research initiatives. But, I mean, if you go get some surgery and the doctor prescribes you OxyContin and you take Oxy, are you inherently hurting yourself? Because that's pretty similar to heroin. It's an opiate. It's just as addictive. Heroin is just the cheaper version on the street. So I don't think that drug use is necessarily hurting oneself. The second thing I'd say is that we already have injection sites all over the city. We already have consumption sites all over the city. Seattle is one big injection and consumption site. That's the reality.
Public bathrooms and alleys and
absolutely
parks, et cetera.
Yeah, Cal Anderson. And people are dying. People are dying on the streets right now. So do we want them to be able to consume safely, or do we want them to continue doing it in unsafe ways and ways that lead to transmission of disease and death?
I haven't heard from Maud yet, and then we will hear from you, Paul. Yes, Maud.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with the idea that it's better to provide a safe location for people to come. I do think it is it's epidemic proportion, not just here, elsewhere in the country as well. And we are losing people. Young people are dying, and other people are dying. So we've done this with needle exchanges for some period of time. I do think how we do it is important. I think it's going to be important to have the ability to actually attempt to offer people support and help in these locations, not just simply to use, because I think that's a pathway for them maybe to find a different way to be. And I also think it's important to maybe have this in a setting where there's really good medical, obviously that would be the goal, but to have good medical supervision. I did read something about how this has been happening, I guess, in Vancouver, and so far there have been overdoses in those locations, but no one has died as a result of those overdoses because they have people on staff. So I think the key thing is the public safety aspect again. And if this is a safer thing, we're not going to lose as many people and we can get them into some form of help and support. I think that's what we should be doing.
Paul, what about that argument that this is a way to help some people, assuming they even need help and other people are free human beings?
Sure. So I wanted to add a quick kind of caring distinction between using a medication that a doctor prescribes, morphine or Oxycontin, which helps a sick person recover their health. That's a goal. And when your health is recovered, you stop taking the medication. Although prescription drug abuse and addiction is its own problem, where a healthy person continues to take the medication for drug because of the drug effect, not because of recovering their health. So I want to make a distinction between medication, which is to restore health, and people who are abusing drugs, who are already healthy, but or should be, and are injecting drugs, which are to get a drug experience, not for any medical purpose, but the result of that is that they're breaking down their body. I mean, they're poisoning themselves. So I'm all in favor, and I think it's a good idea to provide public health services, to provide treatment for free, provide counseling, any aid that will help a person get back on their feet and lead a healthy, balanced life without dependency on the drugs. When they go to a place where the use of the drug is encouraged and facilitated, I think that message overwhelms every other public health message that the authorities are trying to deliver, including the doctors. I think the main message that drug users get is they're telling me that it's okay, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. For some, if it leads out of addiction, that's a good thing. But I think the overall message is mostly harmful.
Sydney, is there no point at which the government says we know the difference between medicine and an escape that usually ends up badly and doesn't allow it?
Well, I think that distinction is arbitrary. And the question I would pose to this group is, does anyone here drink?
I do.
In moderation.
Right. Why do you drink in moderation?
Because alcohol is something that you can consume at a level that's healthy. So,
and you can
along
also,
with other food and drink,
you can also consume it in an unhealthy way. I think
of
we
course,
can
and that's an
that.
Abuse, so,
right?
So that's crossing a line.
But why
is there any healthy level of heroin use?
Yeah, I think there is. You know, why do you have a drink at the end of the day? Sometimes you use it to wind down, to be able to socialize better. People do drugs for the same reason, and I think that research is out there to show that that's the case. The other thing I would say is a lot of people self-medicate when they don't have access to mental health treatment, and drugs are a way of self-medicating.
Okay, again, we're talking about this because Seattle is considering allowing a safe use site modeled, I assume, along the lines of one in Vancouver for both injecting and smoking illegal drugs. Are you okay with Seattle police not enforcing? Well, we sort of talked about that. I also wonder where this would be. Do you know, Sydney, where this would this be a mobile clinic or where they would site this safe use site?
Seattle City Council member Deborah Juarez has said that she wants to put it on Aurora Avenue where, you know, there might be groups of people who need help. But I was interviewing University of Washington senior drug abuse researcher Caleb Banta Green the other day, and he made the very good point that people don't really want to spend a while on commutes to their safe consumption sites. There's a reason, he said, why we have 400 Starbucks in Seattle. It's because we want one right around the corner. So as opposed to Vancouver, I think that if we were going to do safe consumption sites here in Seattle, we would need to have many of them in many different areas.
Or a mobile clinic, or both?
Yeah, or both.
Well, this is the discussion. Residents, you have a chance to let your city know whether you like the idea of allowing a safe use site. We'll talk about it more in the future. We're going to continue with commercialism in your state park on the Week in Review coming up. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Happy Friday to you. Limited commercial advertising is coming to your Washington State Park system. The parks will begin placing ads in the parks as early as this summer. You will not see billboards. You will not be going to Amazon State Park. Although I understand there's a river in South America that has sold its
has naming. Already gotten that brand name.
Yes. This will be advertising posters in some trailhead kiosks. This will be racks with brochures. In a cabin, you might see a directory of local businesses. The park system says they are offsetting declines in taxpayer funding. Sydney, you seem to hate this idea. Why?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that we're bombarded by advertisements every second of our lives. So I don't think it's going to be ruinous if my delicate eyes fall upon an ad for a yurt. But it goes back to the discussion that we were having earlier, like what does it mean for space to be public? And what does it mean when we start to commodify those public spaces? There's a really good example of this on the subway in New York City, actually. Amazon took out ads for the interior of a subway car for this World War II era show, and they covered the interior of the subway in Nazi insignia.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, people reacted poorly, which is totally understandable. But, you know, the question is, it's a slippery slope. Like, when are we going to be hiking through a park and then have bottled water delivered to us by drone, you know, brought to you by Amazon?
Well, let me question your metaphor. We're bombarded by advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
There's a brochure in a trailhead kiosk. Isn't that a little overheated? If you think of it as you being bombarded, I can understand you not liking it. But why bombarded? Why isn't it just information that you can look at or not?
I don't think that people trying to sell you stuff is useful information for the public. I think dispensing useful information to the public is a journalist's job, not an advertiser's.
Paul?
Yeah, I hate this idea too, but I was told not that that's too strong, so that I should present it positively. So what I'll say
No,
is,
if you hate it, you hate it. I was just saying that if you hate something, you probably love something. If
well,
you
exactly.
Dig.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a great point. And so the part I love, and I think everyone here would agree, is I love the outdoors. It's the reason that people live in this area because a public park. It's just that. It's public. I really cannot stand the idea of advertising in public parks, even city parks, because I think that they just should be a zone where there's no commercialism. And I'm a defender of the free market. I like competition and choice and consumer choices. But we do live in a society that is highly commercialized. We are surrounded by advertising messages all the time, which is, again, is okay. We live in a free society. But I do think that if the idea of, you know, a public space, you should be able to go, you know, for your day hike and just not deal with that stuff. I can also add that I'm in favor of contractors providing services. I think it's okay for the government to hire a company to keep the picnic site clean, for example, or take care of the parking lot. But I do not think that that should allow branding or advertising. People should be able to go and get into nature and just escape from all of that.
I wonder what the head of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce thinks about parks of commerce. Maude?
I also hate the idea. I'll just say, I think if you're going to a park, you're going because you do have a love of being in the outdoors and you want to explore something other than your daily existence in an urban atmosphere. And I think, heck, you know, we all know to go to open spaces, you should be prepared. So you don't need the booklets. You kind of probably know your plan. And so I don't know that it's actually helpful for the person. And I tend to believe that people really want to kind of be in open space and green space when they go to parks.
Let's probe this idea of there's open, there's the natural world, and then there's the rest of the world. I hear that from all of you, that we want to be in the natural world, not the world of commerce. I'm not sure I like that division between the natural world. We live in the natural world. I'm getting a nod from Sydney.
Yeah, no, I think that division is completely, again, arbitrary. I agree with you 100%. And I think that instead of fixating on state parks, we should spend more time making our cities healthy to live in, too.
I chime in on that one. I think that's right. In fact, there's huge amounts of effort being made to create more park space in the city, more walkable, livable space in cities, because I think that's really it's so important to people's health. It's important their psychological well-being.
Okay, but pardon, as relates to the topic of advertising in parks, the whole idea, according to the park system, is that we're out of money. Do you want parks to close, or do you want parks to be sustained because there's a brochure in that rack?
I want policymakers to make better priorities about funding core public services, which is what a public park is.
So if that money doesn't come, though, then you're okay with the advertising?
Elect people who will fund them.
And if that doesn't happen, then the brochures.
Exactly.
I have two alternatives we can look to before brochures.
Okay.
The first is I think that we should do outreach to people who don't typically have access to parks, because the data show that people who use national and state parks are overwhelmingly white and relatively affluent. So I think that we could get a lot more people using our parks if we gave them more access to them. The second thing is, if we're so, you know, broke in terms of maintaining our state parks, maybe we should give them back to the tribes we stole them from. I don't know.
Apparently we can't have nice things. Yeah. Sorry, we stole it. Maud?
Well, I tend to be on the side of let's find a better resource than advertising.
But isn't that a common argument? Is let's find another way, and then we don't find the other way, and so then the parks are out of money.
Well, I think we've solved a lot of these problems without resorting to that.
I think the parks are neglected. And for one thing, I mean, there's this odd effect in government budgeting in which, sadly, I'm an expert. This is my area. But there's an effect where policymakers know, kind of on the committee of budgeting, kind of quietly, that when something is popular and they underfund it, then there will be a push to find funding for it.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So that's very
true.
Yeah,
that sounds
right.
What's needed is an expectation on the part of the public that this is a top priority. So, you know, schools, public safety, parks, fund those first. And then if you have other programs you want to fund, let's have a debate about that. So there's this odd reversal that happens.
Okay. The state park system, again, to repeat our story, is going to mandate blaring advertising jingles throughout every park.
On the trails.
No. State Parks and Recreation Commission voted to approve guidelines for accepting advertising. It'll be piloted in 5 state parks in eastern Washington and 5 state parks in western Washington, and then be reevaluated by the Parks Commission. We don't know which parks yet. So you do, listener, have a chance to go to that park and make up your own mind. Or maybe you've already made up your own mind because you listened to KOW Week in Review. Sydney Brownstone, a reporter for The Stranger. So glad you came. Thank you.
Thank you again for having me.
Maud Dodon, president and CEO of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. Great to have you here.
Nice to be here.
And Paul Guppy, vice president for research at the Washington Policy Center. Always a pleasure.
Great. Thank you.
We're live tweeting this show at KOW. Did we make up your mind? Do you have another argument? Do you want to suggest a story, an interview, a way to cover these issues? Let us know. We're at KOW. Engineer Bernard Wallet, producer Andy Hurst, I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in.